Reading from our Bible from chapter 12, chapter 3, verse 37. Pitra, fathers, Bratra, brothers, Suhrit, well-wishing friends, Gyatin, immediate relatives. Hitva, giving up. Sarata, based on sexual relationships. Sauhrada, conception of friendship. Nanandra, with their wives, sisters. Shala, wives, brothers. Samvada, associating regularly. Dina, wretched. Strina, effeminate. Kala, in Kala Yuga. Nara, the men. Translation, Kali Yuga, men will be wretched and controlled by women. They will reject their fathers, brothers, other relatives, and friends will instead associate with the sisters and brothers of the wives. Thus, their conception of friendship will be based exclusively on sexual ties. Text 38. Uncultured men will accept charity on behalf of the Lord and will earn their livelihood by making a show of austerity and wearing a mendicant's dress. Those who know nothing about religion will mount a high seat and presume to speak on religious principles. Text 39 and 40. In the age of Kali, people's minds will always be agitated. They will become emaciated by famine and taxation, my dear king. They will always be disturbed by fear of drought. They will lack adequate clothing, food, and drink, will be unable to properly rest, have sex or bathe themselves, and will have no ornaments to decorate their bodies. In fact, the people of Kali Yuga will gradually come appear to be like ghosts, haunted creatures. Text 41. In Kali Yuga, men will develop hatred for each other, even over a few coins. Giving up all friendly relations, they will be ready to lose their own lives and kill even their own relatives. Text 42. Men will no longer protect their elderly parents, their children, or their respectable wives. Thoroughly degraded, they will care only to satisfy their own bellies and genitals. Purport. In this age, many people are already sending their elderly parents away to lonely and often bizarre old age homes, although the elderly parents spend their entire lives serving their children. Young children are also tormented by in many ways in this age. Suicide among children has increased dramatically in recent years because they are being born not to loving religious parents but to degraded, selfish men and women. In fact, children are often born because of a birth control pill, a prophylactic, or some other contraceptive device malfunctioned. Under such circumstances, it is very difficult nowadays for parents to morally guide their children. Generally ignorant of spiritual science, parents cannot lead their children on the path of liberation, thus fail to fulfill their primary responsibilities in family life. As predicted in this verse, adultery has become common, and people in general are extremely concerned about eating and sex, which they consider far more important than knowing the absolute truth. Text 43, O King, in the age of Kali, people's intelligence will be diverted by atheism, and they will almost never offer sacrifice to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the supreme spiritual master of the universe. Although the great personalities who control the three worlds all bow down to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, the petty and miserable human beings of this age will not do so. Purport, the impulse to find the absolute truth, the source of all existence, has motivated philosophers, theologians, and intellectuals of various persuasions since time immemorial and continues to do so today. However, soberly analyzing the ever-increasing plurality of so-called philosophies, religions, paths of way of life, and so on, we find that in almost all cases, the ultimate objective is something impersonal or formless. But this idea of an impersonal or formless absolute truth has serious logical flaws. According to the ordinary rules of logic, a particular effect should directly or indirectly embody the attributes or nature of its own cause. Thus, that which has no personality or activity could hardly be the source of all personality and all activity. Our irresponsible proclivity to philosophize about the ultimate truth often expresses itself through philosophical, scientific, and mystical attempts to discover that from which everything emanates. This material world, which is a seemingly limitless network of interactive causes and effects, is certainly not the absolute truth, since scientific observation of material elements indicates that the stuff of this world, material energy, is endlessly transformed into different states and shapes. Therefore, one particular instance of material reality cannot be the ultimate source of all other things. We may speculate that matter in some shape or other always existed. This theory, however, is no longer attractive to modern cosmologists, such as those of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And even if we do posit that matter has always existed, we still must explain the source of consciousness if we want to satisfy our philosophical impulse towards discovering the absolute truth. Although modern empirical fanatics state that nothing is real except matter, everyone commonly experiences that consciousness is not the same kind of substance as a stone, pencil, or water. Awareness itself, in contradistinction to the objects of awareness, is not a physical activity, but rather a process of perception and understanding. While there is ample evidence of a systematic interdependent relationship between matter and consciousness, there is no rigid empirical evidence whatsoever that matter is the cause of consciousness. Thus, the theory that the material world has always existed and is therefore the ultimate truth does not scientifically or even intuitively explain the source of consciousness, which is the most fundamentally real aspect of our existence. Furthermore, as demonstrated by Richard Thompson in this State University of New York at Binghamton, and confirmed by several Nobel laureates in physics who have praised his work, the nature laws of nature governing the transformation of matter simply do not contain sufficiently complex information to account for the inconceivable complexity of events taking place within our own bodies and those of other life forms. In other words, not only do the material laws of nature fail to account for the existence of consciousness, but they cannot explain even the interaction of material elements at complex organic levels. Even Socrates, the first great Western philosopher, was disgusted with the attempts to establish ultimate causality in terms of mechanistic principles. The heat and luminosity of the sun's rays demonstrate to the satisfaction of any rational man that the sun, the source of the rays, is certainly not a dark, cold globe, but rather a reservoir of almost unlimited heat and light. Similarly, the innumerable instances of personality and personal consciousness within creation are more than adequate to demonstrate the existence somewhere of an unlimited reservoir of consciousness and personal behavior. In his dialogue, Philebus, the Greek philosopher, Plato argued that just as the material elements in our body are derived from a vast reservoir of material elements existing within the universe, our rational intelligence is also derived from a great cosmic intelligence existing within the universe, and the supreme intelligence is God, the Creator. Unfortunately, in Kali Yuga, many leaders cannot understand this and instead deny that the absolute truth, the source of our personal consciousness, has consciousness and personality. This is reasonable as saying that the sun is. This is as reasonable as saying the sun is cold and dark. In Kali Yuga, many people present cheap, stereotype arguments such as if God has a body or a personality, he would be limited. In this inadequate attempt at logic, a qualified term is falsely presented as a universal sense. What really should be said is if God had a material body or a material personality like those we have experienced, he would be limited. But we leave out the qualified adjective material and make a pseudo-universal assertion as if we understood the full range within total reality of bodies and personality. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and other Vedic literatures teach that the transcendental form and personality, the absolute truth, are unlimited. Clearly, to be truly infinite, God must not only quantitatively but also qualitatively be infinite. Unfortunately, in our mechanistic industrial age, we tend to define infinity only in its quantitative sense, and thus we fail to notice that an infinity of personal qualities is a necessary aspect of infinity. In other words, God must have infinite beauty, infinite wealth, infinite intelligence, infinite humor, infinite kindness, infinite anger, and so on. Infinite is an absolute, and if anything we observe in the world is not contained somehow or other within our conception of the absolute, then that conception is of something limited and not of the absolute at all. Only in Kali Yuga are these philosophers foolish enough to proudly define the most absolute of all terms, God, in materialistic relative ways, and then declare themselves enlightened thinkers. No matter how big our brain may be, we should have the common sense to place it at the feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation, O King, in the age of Kali, people's intelligence will be diverted by atheism. They will almost never offer sacrifice to the Supreme Personality of God, who is the Supreme Spiritual Master of the universe. Although the great personalities who control the three worlds all bow down to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, the petty and miserable human beings of this age will not do so. So, previously in this chapter, we've seen all the bad qualities that manifest in Kali Yuga in terms of conduct and whatever. Destruction of varna and ashram, destruction of morality, destruction of all the different rules you normally follow in society. And this we attribute to the cycle of the ages in which Kali is the worst and last age dominated by Tamagun, which is also, we say, the will of the Lord in construction of material energy. It degenerates to a simple state of Tama, even though the Lord begins it with Sattva, which we also see in the basic creation that is Sarga, where we have Mahavishnu glancing over unmanifest Prakriti, and then it transforms into what? Mahatattva. Mahatattva is considered very pure. Of course, it's matter, but it's considered very pure. The jivas are there, but the jivas exist in a very sattvic state. The covering of tamagun does not look apparent at all. The state of Mahatattva is considered to be shining. It's full of light. It's like a big golden egg. So the state of Mahatattva is very sattvic. In fact, the most sattvic state of in the material world, we can say. Prakriti is invisible. Mahatattva is visible. It's manifest Prakriti, but very sattvic. But this gradually transforms into a rajasic state called sutra, and into a tamasic state called ahankara. And then ahankara gives rise to a sattvic state, a sub-state of under ahankara, that's ignorance, sattva, which creates the mind, and rajagun, which creates the senses, and tamagun, which creates gross material elements. And then they all combine together and produce things. So basically, once Prakriti has degraded itself into a tamasic state, then we get the manifestation of mind, senses, body, material elements, which form into living entities and material worlds. So we know 14 worlds and all the creatures within the material world. So basically, it's a tamasic state. Tamasic state of Prakriti. So, though the Lord says that sattva is better than rajagun and tamagun, there's a prominence of tamagun. It always seems to appear again and again. So we get the cycle of ages, sattva, treta, dwarpa, kali. So gradually sattva transforms into tamagun, which is natural because matter itself is tamasic. Then suddenly the Lord restores sattva and it gradually declines again, tamagun. So the nature of matter itself is to reach an equal, stable position of tamagun always. So we have to struggle to maintain the sattvic state. It has to be done. Of course, we don't struggle in one sense because we get the mercy of the Lord, then it can be maintained. So the Lord does this by instituting dharma in the material world to encourage sattva. Of course, dharma itself encompasses sattva, raja, and tama. Therefore, we have some people in tamagun, they are called sudras, and some in rajagun called vaishyas, and some in rajagun, sattvagun, kshatriyas, and then we have those in sattvagun called brahmanas. So dharma, the system of dharma under the great kings descended from Manu, they institute the system in which all the gunas are represented, but the goal is to get people to the sattvic state. So we have to have a system there to keep the sattva up. And that system is destroyed. Back down to tamagun again. So simultaneously as the ages go on, adharma and tamagun increases, and simultaneously we find a destruction of dharma. Adharma increases, tamagun increases, dharma decreases, sattva decreases. So that system itself of dharma also decreases, and suddenly it is useless in Kali Yuga. It gets destroyed. The Manu's descendants disappear, and the system of kings is replaced by thieves and cheaters instead. So, therefore, the basic system in Kali Yuga, the system for maintaining normal dharma, becomes absent. So naturally, Tamagun can prosper like anything. As long as Krishna was on the planet, Tamagun, even though it was approaching, it could not get in there, it could not influence. Kali could not influence. When Krishna disappeared, and then, of course, along with them, the Pandavas disappeared, and then only Parikshit was left. Parikshit held everything together and kept the Dharma intact. When he disappeared, then it crumbled away. So in Kali Yuga, the whole system is, of Dharma is missing. And a Dharma becomes prominent. So that is expressed here in these verses where we find all the bad habits of the people, bad qualities of the people, which stems from the fact that the immediate fact that Dharma is missing. So what does Dharma do? It maintains all these different things that they're not doing here. For instance, the men don't protect their families or their parents. So protection is one of the aspects of Dharma. You have duties to your parents, you have duties to your children, you have duties to the wife, etc. All the duties are strongly emphasized so that the social system is intact. And when there's nobody there to enforce it, then it just starts to disintegrate. Very, very difficult. Of course, if the social system is intact with the king, that's the best thing. So when the kings disappear, then that system fails. Now, then we have the secondary system, that is the family itself can maintain, or the community can maintain their rules of Dharma. So somewhat intact. But then that starts to get corrupted also. And so we get all sorts of problems. So that is why in ancient system, they always emphasize the system. Maintain the system, maintain the rule of order, maintain the family, etc. And another problem in Kali Yuga is the family gets attacked because then they start intermarrying and get all sorts of weird things happening. And then the whole family system disappears also because whose tradition we're following, husbands or wife or whatever like this. And we end up with all sorts of strange combinations. So the family systems also get disturbed or confused, and nobody knows what to do finally. So in this way, not only the government itself and the kings, that system goes, but even the family and the community traditions start getting confused, and what they don't know what they're doing anymore. So in this way, the rules again become weakened. Added to that, we have the influence of Tamagun itself, which creates ignorance. So even if the rules are there, people don't know what the rules are for. So they're following all these rules and then they begin to question, what are the rules for? And nobody can answer them. Therefore, they just give the rules. What's the use of these rules? And they give them up. So, in this way, in Kali Yuga, due to the influence of Tamagun, then regulation stops. So, it was mentioned previously in the first canto how in Kali Yuga, the four sinful activities become prominent, and the four qualities, good qualities, get destroyed due to sinful activities like meat eating, gambling, intoxication, illicit sex activity, and hoarding of money. These things tend to destroy the pillars of Dharma, such as cleanliness and truth and compassion and sense control, tapas. So these things, aspects of Dharma are gradually destroyed. So at the beginning of Kali Yuga, we have one quarter Dharma left. One quarter of these things left. End of Kali Yuga, it goes down to almost zero. So, very bad prediction for the future of the world. So this is how Dharma decreases. So the immediate cause of this is that destruction of the kings and the dharmic system. And that is due to, ultimately, the rise of Tamagun. So what is one to do in this position? So the real solution is to go beyond Dharma itself. And even if Dharma doesn't exist, we have to find something which is can exist, even when there is no Dharma. So that is bhakti. These other things become dependent upon the whole one that's dependent on the other, the king and the system and the families and society all go together, and then it works. And when you start getting corruption of these elements, the whole thing falls apart. So that is the nature of Kali Yuga. Everything gets destroyed. So what is the hope for people? What is the hope for the human being in Kali Yuga if all this is destroyed? In the sense of Dharma, it is very difficult to do. Very difficult to keep it together because of the influences over the whole of the world due to nature of Kali Yuga. So, yes, it is quite hopeless. And consequently, even religious activities become hopeless because religious activities are connected to Dharma. In Dharma we have worship of David, this worship of the Supreme Lord, knowledge, understanding you're not the soul, the body, you're the soul, like this. So all these other processes also cannot be function properly, particularly because jnana and yoga can only function in sattvic state. And Kali Yuga is the opposite, it's tamasic state. So difficult. So automatically, so what happens is karma yoga is not there. Jnana yoga can't be done. Sangha yoga cannot be done. So only bhakti's left, finally. So, this is the process that becomes most prominent in Kali Yuga. In the other yugas, Dharma is there. That does not mean bhakti's not there. Bhakti's also there. And it is the life of all the other processes. So it must be there in any case. But in Kali Yuga, nothing else functions at all. Only bhakti can function. So it must become more prominent and more obvious in Kali Yuga. It's the only process. So we may doubt that because bhakti is the highest process, and if the lower processes can't operate, how can bhakti operate at all? And the answer to that is Supreme Lord. It is the will of the Supreme Lord. And the Supreme Lord is behind bhakti more than is behind Dharma or Yoga or Astanga Yoga or Jnana or anything else. And that is made very clear in many places in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Bhagavatam, such as 11th Canto, where the Supreme says, I don't care for Dharma and Sankhya and all of this. I care for bhakti. And in 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna say? What is better to do? Gradual system, go through karma yoga and jnana and sangha yoga, realize atma, and then come to bhakti. Or just do bhakti. Krishna says, easier just do bhakti. Instead of raising yourself from tamaguna to rajaguna to sattvaguna and then coming to bhakti after that, just do bhakti no matter what guna you're in. And he says, the process of bhakti is quick. Why? Because you get the mercy of the Lord. More than you get mercy in the other systems of Dharma and Karma Yoga and Jnana and Astanga Yoga. Yeah, I don't care for these things. Of course the Lord approves them, so in one sense mercy is there, but the real mercy is in bhakti. So much so that if one attains prem bhakti, the Lord falls under the control of the devotee. This is the sixth quality of bhakti. Krishna Karshni. Bhakti attracts Krishna. So that is manifest fully in the state of prema, where one's bhakti is pure. But even in the beginning stages of bhakti, the Lord is more attracted to the devotee, even if he's a neophyte, a kanishta adhikar. He's attracted to him more than he's attracted to the karma yogi, the jnana yogi, and the sangha yogi. He's more attracted. So the nature of Krishna is to be attracted to bhakti. Therefore, the devotee gets mercy. So we have many examples in Bhagavatam that disregard the whole system of Dharma, etc. Bhagavatam says that the most fallen person, the Chandala or whatever, he's not in the Varnashram system. And he chants the name of the Lord once. He's superior to the highest person in the Varnashram system. How does it happen? Just chanting once with faith. So that is the power of bhakti because of the mercy of the Lord. He is directly involved. How can such a person be purified instantaneously? Because the Lord can do this. The Lord is in control of karma. The Lord is ultimately in control of everything in the material world. So if he wants, he can destroy all the karmas for the devotee of the Lord. In fact, the power of the name of the Lord is so strong that even if you don't have faith and you chant it, you can destroy all your karmas instantaneously. So it says that Ajumil destroyed all of his karmas, not at the end of his life from constantly chanting the name of Narayan, but when he first named his son Narayana, then all of his karmas got destroyed, past, present, future. No faith. Accidental chanting of the name of Narayan. But that name is very powerful. And of course, hopefully, this leads to bhakti, etc. And when we chant with faith and devotion, with bhakti, then how much more power the name will have. So removing karma and all this is not a big deal. It's not a big endeavor for the Supreme Lord. He does this even for accidental bhakti. What to speak of intentional bhakti, real bhakti. You can do that. So, therefore, one should not underestimate the statements of scripture which glorify bhakti and glorify the chanting of the name of the Lord. So that is an example to show how the karmas, destroying karmas, is not a difficult process for bhakti. So, if one sincerely devotes oneself to the Lord, chants the name of the Lord, follows the correct procedures under the guidance of devotees, then the Lord becomes very pleased with that person. And anything becomes possible at that point, because the Lord is in control of everything. Ultimately, the cause of all the thing is that people forget the Supreme Lord. Yes, Dharma and all that is there, but ultimately, if people are to remember the Supreme Lord at all times and worship the Supreme Lord at all times, then they can prevent everything from happening. You can have your system of Dharma, you can have all the other systems intact, everything. But if you worship the Supreme Lord, then you are, in any case, protected. So the main principle then in Kali Yuga is to propagate among the population the process of bhakti. That is important. So a few people can do it, but then the rest of the population is full of maya. So the Yuga Dharma, the process which all people can partake of in Kali Yuga, is the chanting of the holy name of the Lord as Nam Sankirtan. Just as meditation was widespread in Satya Yuga, because people were very sattvic and they could control their senses and mind very easy by nature. So directly they can remember the Supreme Lord for long periods of time. They cannot do that in Kali Yuga. Nevertheless, they also, by the mercy of the Lord, they can partake of bhakti anyway. So the process of doing it is chanting the name of the Lord. The effect of that is that ultimately they remember the Lord. As is said in the Nectar Devotion, the sum and substance of all rules is to always remember the Lord and never forget Him. Those are the two main rules of all the processes, kirtan and association of devotees and deity worship, etc. Get the mind concentrated on the Supreme Lord. So it's easy in Satya Yuga to do that. Directly meditation is the process. Kali Yuga they cannot do. Mind is not controlled. So the way of accomplishing that constant thought of the Supreme Lord is Nam Sankirtan. So what does it do? Destroys all the karmas, destroys all the desires, destroys the false ego, does all of this, so that you can fix your mind on the Supreme Lord. So that is the process to follow. So remembrance of the Lord in all cases, that is the solution. And in Kali Yuga, the way of doing that is through chanting the name of the Lord. So this is to be the predicted to be the common process, or the popular process and the effective process for the majority of the people in Kali Yuga. So it is called the Yuga Dharma. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to introduce it, and then he ordered his followers to spread it everywhere in the material world. To fulfill that prediction of being a Yuga Dharma, it has to be spread everywhere. So therefore he gave that order, and the Goswamis and all of his devotees followed that order in propagating the holy name. And in our Sampradaya then we have Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada also endeavoring with all of their efforts to spread it everywhere. So we're coming in this particular line of propagating the name of the Lord as the effective means of delivering the people of Kali Yuga. Okay, any questions? Well, actually, I think it's Vishnu Chakravarti in his commentary says that we should not think that, you know, one after the other, like truthfulness disappears and then one, then austerity disappears and then whatever like that. But rather, that in Satya Yuga we have 100% of all of them. And then in Treta Yuga, 75% of all of them. And then in, so it's just percentage wise in terms of the legs, it's percentage-wise, full, three-quarters, half, one-quarter. So one-quarter dharma left in Kali Yuga, one-quarter of these principles left.
But in first encounter, we see that Parashit Maharaj was trying to eat the full and it's having one leg and
yeah.
Taking it.
Yes.
So in the book, it's been explained.
Yeah.
Only one religiosity is doing it in Kali Yuga, and that is shaped. So in that sense,
yeah, but in general, all of them, everything declines proportionately, like from full to one quarter. And I suppose in Kali Yuga, we say there's a prominence of, let's say, truthfulness, some hope for that, whereas the other ones are completely destroyed. Huh? But so, let's say, it's percentage-wise, it's a little more prominent, but nevertheless, all of them are very, very little. Even the truthfulness is very little. Obviously, we cannot say that everyone's truthful in Kali Yuga, no. We don't have 100% truthfulness and everything else zero. So we got a little truthfulness and almost zero of everything else. So it's a little more prominent, but nevertheless, everything is less than a quarter.
Speech Master always advised us, other than chanting, we have to read books as well. So we have to also concentrate on knowledge as well?
Yes. Because for the devotee, in the performance of bhakti, we need certain knowledge. If we don't have that knowledge, the bhakti cannot be executed properly. So kirtan is good for everybody in the sense that even Ajamil, accidentally it purifies him. Huh? And if we do it with a little knowledge, yes, it's also good. But if you want to get the real goal, that is prema, then you have to have proper knowledge. So that is why we also have sadhu sangha, etc. Then we have to do association with devotees. Through that we get the proper knowledge by which we understand the nature of God, the nature of devatas, the nature of jivas, the nature of prakriti, the nature of bhakti specifically. If we just say yes, do bhakti, devotion to the Lord, fine, but then how do you do that bhakti? What does it mean? Okay? So we have definitions of bhakti, a very fundamental definition given in the Nectar Devotion. And then there's other types of devotion also, but they're not the highest devotion. So the devotion that we are speaking of when we talk about bhakti is pure bhakti, not the mixed bhakti and not other forms of bhakti. Only that pure bhakti. That will give prema. So if we don't understand that, then we kind of waste a lot of time doing these other things and we get something that's not prema in the end. So what's the use? Huh? So to get the proper goal, we have to do the proper sadhana. To get the proper sadhana, and we have to have the proper knowledge of the process and of the philosophy. So therefore, yes, knowledge is necessary. That is not the jnana in the sense that we should not cover bhakti with jnana. That jnana is a different jnana. That's the impersonal aspect of jnana, which is unfavorable for bhakti.
Right. we see in spirituality that some mantras are openly given to the public, while some other mantras are not. Like Gayatri is kept very confidential, not given to the public.
Because mantras are secret in general, they should be given by guru. And particularly Vedic mantras and even Pancharatrika mantras are private things. You require qualification, which means the guru has to judge the disciple. When he's qualified, he can give mantra. You can't just give mantras to everybody. We call Hare Krishna a mantra. Technically, it's nama. It is only the names of the Lord. A mantra is defined as the name of the Lord, which is put in the dative case, like Krishnaya or Vasudevaya or Vishnave. That's a dative case, with namaha or swaha or some such terminology and a few other words there. That becomes a mantra, and that is not public. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, for instance. That's a mantra. That should not be given out publicly. But I think Ramanuja gave it out publicly anyway, to fight his guru. But generally not given out. And that is given by the Diksha Guru.
It seems even to do that is not such an easy thing. Even that kind of chanting without faith, to the extent that it cleanses all of one's karma, doesn't seem to be so common.
Oh, okay. Well, it's easy in the sense that you don't do anything and you simply get the effect by calling your son Narayan or Govind or whatever. And the first time it clears all your offenses, so we can be asked, well, look, it doesn't look like he gets his, you know, all of his karmas destroyed or whatever. He's still suffering, he still has bad habits, etc. That is the case even in Ajamil. Because after he named his son Narayan, he was still attached to his son, still attached to the whatever, second wife or whatever, prostitute. Still doing weird activities. It looked like it. Yeah? So, Vishnu Chakravarti explains that there is it's an appearance, but actually he didn't have any karmas at that point. So what was happening was, the Lord hid the results, and suddenly he becomes a pure devotee by accidentally chanting. He hides that result by keeping the intact, that covering. It looks like karmas and desires and everything. He kept that covering there because he does not always want to reveal the glory of bhakti and discourage other processes like karma yoga and jnana and sangha yoga. So he covers it up. The other point is that when he was doing the activities after that, even though they looked sinful, they didn't give any result. No sinful reaction. Why? Because it's like the snake with the no teeth. Biting and there's no effect. So he was doing the activities, there was no karma for that because the name was chanted. So when he died, he actually died earlier than he should have because of his previous sinful activities. That was an effect. But Yamaraj could not touch him, couldn't take him because actually there was no sinful activities. It was all disappeared. It all disappeared. All of them. And even though he was doing activities that looked like they were sinful after that, that also had no effect. So Yamaraj's servants couldn't touch him at all because of that. And therefore he had to come back to life. So that is the one case. The other case is that, or the other condition is that, one should not also have aparad involved in that, even accidental chanting. So the aparad would be to have false concepts about the Supreme Lord in that accidental chanting, that actually we don't like the Lord and we are hostile to the Lord and we think he's got a material body and he's just a devata, all these things are aparad. So if that is there, then Ajamil wouldn't have had the effect. But he was just kind of blank, fortunately, so he got that effect. Oh, well, it says there that the devotees discuss among themselves, yes? They mutya discuss, so they're getting knowledge there, bhakti jnana or Bhagavad jnana at that time. Hearing is a process, so we hear from devotees and we get it. Now, of course, the Lord also reveals from within. Huh?
So the Lord says, I give you the intelligence by which you can come to me. So, yes, probably in very extreme circumstances, one is isolated on an island in the middle of the ocean, maybe, and you don't have any chance to get association or books or anything. Yes, the Lord is going to give you inspiration if you're sincere and help you and guide you in the right path. So that's internal guidance of the Lord there. The usual process is that He will arrange for you to meet devotees of the Lord who have proper knowledge and scripture, etc., and they will give you that knowledge. So that is the process of hearing. So we hear from devotees and associate with devotees and we get knowledge. Of course, along with that, when we get the knowledge and we make attempts at devotional service, it is the Lord who helps us get realization of that knowledge and really understand what it is. Yeah? In the Nectar Devotion there, Rupa Goswami says at the end of the beginning section there that you cannot really understand this book or anything about bhakti, the analysis of rasa and bhakti, etc., by logic. Material logic does not work. So you do have to have that faith and bhakti and ruchi and taste behind you. Yeah? So the Lord helps us develop that bhakti and develop the true understanding of what these scriptures are saying. So it's a combination of the Lord's inspiration to us plus our endeavor to actually hear properly from the devotees and get their mercy. Yeah, see, that is mentioned one place in the purport in a discussion of when Vyasadeva appeared. And he appeared at the junction of the yugas where there was a viparya. Huh? Now, that word is a little strange because it can mean reversal, but it can also mean a succession. The one succeeds the next. So one age succeeds the next. So I looked in the commentaries on that verse and most of them don't really say anything about a reversal as such, so they just take it as one yuga following the other at the junction of the two yugas. So when Dwarpa was ending and Kali Yuga was beginning, that is the Sandhi, in that period, Vyasadeva appeared. Yeah. Someone, I think, I don't know if it's authentic or not, but they said there was some thing about some Muni or sage or something that in Ramchandra's time that did something with the reversal of yugas or something like that. But directly, we don't see anything in the commentaries about that in the Bhagavatam. It would be a little bit weird because then if this R1 is a reversal only, then in general it should be the other way around, but we don't see that listed anywhere as the general cycle. And if it is the general cycle, then would the time periods be different? And the qualities be different? Would the dwarfa, the lesser qualities be the previous ones, or what? I mean, this is hard to figure out what that reversal would mean.
We see like Uttara Path, when he was ruling the kingdom, so and then Dhruva Maharaj came. But again, when we go to the second branch, Priyavrata Maharaj, when he was given the charge, was actually forced to give a charge because there was no right person. So how do we understand? Because Dhruva Maharaj himself ruled the kingdom for 35,000 years, then again his grandfather came and gave the kingdom to Priyavrata.
Mm-hmm.
So are we talking same universe or they are simultaneously at different places?
Well, they live a long time, you know. Thousands and thousands of years they ruled. I think Priyavrata lived for, I don't know, millions of years or something like that. So they live long periods of times. And when there's no proper descendant, like from Dhruva or something, then they have to go back and choose another part of the line. That's all.
So my question was, Dhruva's grandfather, right? So he again came back and gave this kingdom to Priyavrata. How this could be possible?
No. Come back in sense of what?
Like, father and Priyavrata, they are contemporaries, they are brothers.
Yeah.
And
then Dhruva ruled,
yeah,
and then supposedly didn't have any descendants or something, and therefore it's the right of the other brother to take up and his line can continue. That's all. And they all lived a long time.
they're talking about his father as well. Like, his father came and he intervened in the situation and gave it to...
Yeah. Well, it could be, whatever, but if he's there or not, doesn't matter. But as I said, they all live a very long period of time, and then they may resign from the throne and give it to their son. They can still be there. And if need arises, then, and they have no descendants from Dhruva's line, then they can arrange for the other brother to take up the thing. But they all live very long periods of time. That's the main thing. And then they must somehow continue the system. And if the father's not there, then the Brahmins will judge who's the next in line. And we'll try to choose somebody in that line. Sometimes there are anomalies, as in the case of Vena. He got in there, and he was in the line, but somehow due to the marriage, the progeny was bad. So therefore, they assassinated him. And then they had a problem because there was no line of kings. So then they took the body and they churned the body and cloned the body, whatever, of the dead king. And out of that, they got Prithu, who was also considered to be in the line because he came from his body, and at the same time he was a Shakti Vaishnavadara of the Lord. So,
sometimes we hear Pandavas undergoing suffering.
Not karma.
Not karma.
Arrangement of the Lord,
yeah.
Only.
So sometimes Duryodhana is also very antagonistic towards Pandavas. So like, how do you distinguish which is last plan and which is karma, the individual soul's karma? Like,
yeah, well, Duryodhana is considered to be the incarnation of Kali Yuga, evil personified. So he's definitely not, that's not Leela of the Lord, that he's just doing that for Leela. Actually, he's a good person. No? But the Pandavas are Nitya Siddha devotees of the Lord. So any so-called suffering is not real suffering, that's arrangement of the Lord. Or any bewilderment is not real bewilderment, it's also arrangement of the Lord. Yeah, just as Arjuna on the battlefield was confused and bewildered. So that is not real bewilderment because he's eternally the Lord's friend. So it's only Yoga Maya acting for a particular purpose of the Lord. Or Parikshit also. Why did he insult the Brahmana and get afflicted by hunger and thirst so much that he would insult the Brahmana when he was the king and he knew Dharma? The only reason is Lord's will. Yoga Maya operated so that Bhai wouldn't get spoken.
In the first half of the conversation between the cow and the bull,
yeah.
Is that considered some kind of symbolic something or other? Or
that's,
that
yeah, that's allegorical. That's
allegorical.
Allegorical. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Though the cow, we can say that happens in the Prithu story also. The earth takes the form of a cow, so to speak, like that. So that seems to be allegorical also.
But if you understand the cause and effect of a karma, say for example, a person is supposed to get the reaction of his bad karmas from the previous life.
Mm.
So he's being stabbed by someone.
Mm-hmm.
But if you consider that whole situation, one person is getting bad effect, but other person is abusing his grief.
Yeah.
So is it the combination of two that makes that activity happen?
Yeah, we cannot say that the guy stabbing the guy, that's his karma to kill him. We can't say that. Because that way you could justify any act in the material world. So it's his free will and his irresponsibility by which he does an act of violence to another person. Nevertheless, it may not be, we don't know if that's exactly a karma, but it may be a karma that person has to suffer at that moment. So therefore, that opportunity is taken where the knife hits him or something like that. So it's a combination of free will and of karma or whatever.
So we get bad effects even if we don't deserve it. That's what.
What's that?
You understand from that?
What's that?
So in that situation, if the other person has abused his will,
yeah.
But what about the person who received it? Did he deserve that, or he just happened to be there?
Well, it depends, because sometimes you can also aggravate a person and then he stabs you. Because you get angry at a person, you insult him, then he stabs you. So that's not exactly karma. That's our foolishness that we got angry and insulted a person. Yeah? Or the same with the person that walks across the street and has an accident. Well, you say I'm invincible, and you put a blindfold on and walk across the street, and you get run over by an automobile. That's not your karma so much as your foolishness at the moment. So not everything is karma. Some is foolishness. Or if you smoke cigarettes and you get lung cancer, that's not karma. That's foolishness. or you get drunk and you have a car crash and you kill somebody, then that's not karma also. That's your foolishness again. And you get karma for that also. So not everything that happens is not karma. It's our own actions at the moment also that produce immediate results.
What's the role of a manu in the Kali Yuga?
A what?
What's the role of a manu?
The manus have disappeared. It's mentioned here in this particular chapter that the present descendants of manu are hiding up in the Himalayas and they won't appear again until Satyuga manifests and they start the new dynasty when Satyuga comes. Meanwhile, they're disappeared and they're not here. So that part of that, the rulership is all more or less irregular at the moment. No empowered kings. Manus are actually, and their descendants are considered to be vibhutis of the Lord. They're representatives of the Lord. They're not like Shaktivesh avatars, but they are posts who are given special powers by the Lord, like devatas.
Maharaj, is natural disaster arrangement of the Lord?
What's
natural disasters?
Well, it's a combination of sinful activities of human beings in general, as in the case of the story of the cow and the bull, Dharma and Earth. And Dharma was the bull, and Earth is the cow. So the two things are very intimately related together. So as the Dharma decreases and Adharma increases, the cow suffers more and more, which means the earth suffers more and more as we do more and more sinful activities. So earth suffering more and more means the earth does not give what it's supposed to give and we get the opposite effect. So the more we do sinful activities, the more the earth does not cooperate with us and we get more problems in terms of irregular weather or whatever, earthquakes or whatever. So we can say it's more the human situation, but as the ages decrease the Kali Yuga, then of course we're going to expect more of that because there's more sinful activity, more tamagun, and more corruption of the earth and whatever. So therefore, we'll get more worse effects in Kali Yuga because of that. So the Lord makes the rule, and then if we don't follow, then we get the results.
Yeah, sometimes devotees also suffer during that situation.
Yeah. So well, the devotees can exist in heaven or hell. The real devotee does not care. He's impervious to those situations. Takes it as the mercy of the Lord only. Why they don't come anymore?
Yeah.
Oh, well, Prabhupada said that it's so unattractive. It's like a latrine or something where you don't want to go to. You've got all the sinful activities of people. So devatas don't like to manifest themselves here. We'll see in the Bhagavatam, for instance, when they had sacrifices, you know, then the devatas would appear, or even the kumaras would appear, and Lord would appear, because it was so devotional and pure. But in Kali Yuga, there's no purity, so they're not interested in making their appearance here for that reason. The influence is felt in terms of delivering us our karmas. So they are immediately involved in, you know, helping with distribute the effects of your sinful activities, etc. So they're involved in that, but they don't manifest themselves. Yeah. How was the difference? Well, it's called Kalpa Beda. Different days of Brahma will have slightly different leelas, so there can be different accounts of it in different ages, you know, in different days of Brahma. That is why, like the itihasas and puranas are not eternal, because each day the records are going to be a little different, because the versions are slightly different every day of Brahma. So the words are not eternal in the sense they keep changing every day.
What argument did you give? Why we can't follow the Karma Yuga and Kali Yuga?
What's that?
to get that, we have to depend on bhakti only. But
yeah.
What argument do you give for...
No kings left to institute dharma. The manus have disappeared.
Karma yoga. Why can't we have karma yoga and karma yoga?
Well, karma yoga means basically varnashram system. The varnashram system depends on the king to control very strongly and institute, make everybody follow properly all the rules and regulations of varna and ashrama. But there's no king, so it's very difficult to do that now. Everyone will chant, what right have you to tell me what to do? The sudras will say, you can't institute us because we're the majority. Sudras are the majority. They got all the votes, so they, you cannot order us what to do. We're the majority. So you know, it's very difficult to institute varnashram and karma yoga. We got democracy now, but varnashram means no democracy. The king is the one who has the knowledge and the power. And the ignorant people, you don't trust them. They can't think properly, so why give them any power? Is it demons being born or whatever? Well, the disasters are not so big as that. And also the, just as I said, Kali Yuga itself, because it's a prominence of tamagun and sinful activities, this is naturally going to affect the earth to react. So this isn't that, most of it is just a reaction to all the sinful activities going on earth, that's all. Not a particular demon being born, but basically the... just the general prominence of sin. If a big demon gets born, then the Lord appears and counteracts that somehow.
Okay. Hare Krishna.